April 25th, 2026, Waiagiri Monastery. Wonderful to see all of you coming here to practice. And I'm also very grateful to have the opportunity to be able to be in the position of service in this community and being able to help with leading this community. And I feel like we're a really good community right now, a really strong team, the monastic community, the lay community, and there's this very good relationship. And for myself, different stages of life as a monastic, it's starting out as an anagarika, as a novice, and then as a young bhikkhu, and trying to find ways to cultivate the practice, trying to find techniques for just coming to puja and doing the meditation and struggling with the hindrances, and then finding ways to just be able to follow the routine so that it's of benefit for us. And the late night vigils, the all night sits, the last night was the half moon wanpra, so there wasn't a mandatory all night vigil, but still there was a handful of people who stayed up. And that's a very important part of our tradition coming from Lumpur Cha. So anumodana for people who stayed up last night and for everybody who's coming here to practice. And for myself, in a position of being called the abbot of the monastery, then I'm very grateful to be in that position because it's less about teaching. I find it's less about teaching and it's more about learning. So I've been able to learn more than before, say in the past 7 years or so that I've been in this position of helping to lead the community, then it's a time of learning. And then I find it's actually quite good because my mistakes that I inevitably make, they get pointed out to me far more quickly. Whereas because I'm under the microscope, I actually, when I first came here, I would consider myself quite an introvert and not someone who likes to be in the public eye. And so this is, for me, it's a real sense of sacrifice and surrender in order to be in more of a position of being like a public figure. And I have a little bit of a personal life, but not much at this point. And that's a great blessing. That's actually a great blessing because it can highlight some of the hindrances more and can highlight some of the defilements more. And that is, if it's held in the right way, then it's a blessing. So I hope that when I'm an old monk, that I'm not full of resentment and just walking around the monastery muttering criticisms and complaints under my breath. I have to set that intention now to not become like that. But it's actually easy to not be like that. I could be like that if I wanted to, but it's easy because there's so much goodness here. And yeah, it's great to be here. And I did a lot of traveling at the end of last year and the beginning of this year. And so I was in Thailand until the 1st of March. And I was so happy to get back. And I was doing these upachaya preceptor trainings in these huge monastic institutions in Thailand. And it's certainly, for us those of us who live here at Waiagiri, it's not something that we're used to. It really is like it's going to a different universe. And coming back here and just getting back up into the forest, so nice. And I'm reminded of these suttas, the verses of Mahakasapa, Venerable Mahakasapa, like, these rocky crags refresh me. So just springtime and forest is really beautiful right now. And walking into the forest and just exploring some of the forest and sitting in the forest and just going for slow walks in the forest and doing a little bit of meditation. in the forest and thinking, this is very wonderful, very good for the health, for both bodily and mental health. And it's quite a blessing to be able to have this land, this situation that we have here at Abhayagiri. And we're happy to share it with everybody who wants to come here to practice. But not just anybody can experience this. We have to, if we want to live at Abhayagiri, we need to be able to keep the precepts. And that's the gold standard for being able to live here, is the precepts. And so as long as we're keeping the precepts, we get to live here and experience this place. You could say we get a license to experience this place. And if we're practicing, we will be very refreshed by living in a place like this. However, if we're lost in the suffering, if the heart is filled with despair and a sense of not being well, not feeling well, then we won't be refreshed by this place. We won't be able to see everything that's around us. It's like you could have two people standing in a forest, and one of them could be marveling at the wonderful smells of the medicinal herbs in the forest and the bay laurel and the different nice smells. And the creek is running right now, so the clear water, the streams, the frogs making their noises, the birds, and kind of delighting in that. And another person could be standing next to them and just thinking, oh, I can't believe that person said that to me, and not experiencing all of those things that are all around us. So it's all inside. Our internal world really conditions our external world. Our internal world, you could call that the vipaka gama, the results of past actions. That's what we're experiencing. And so really the core of the Buddha's teachings, if we talk about either the Four Noble Truths or Paticca-samuppada, the dependent origination, and the Four Noble Truths is a summary of dependent origination. When the Buddha teaches these things, then it's teaching about, this is a framework for how to see our experience. What are we experiencing? How are we experiencing things? Or the Buddha teaches about the five khandhas. So these three cardinal suttas that we chant all the time here at Abhayagiri, we've got the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, so that's the Buddha's first discourse. We've got the Anattalakkhana Sutta, and so that's the Buddha teaching the first five disciples and bringing them to a state of completion, to the end of the path in their practice. And then the fire sermon, the Adita Pariyaya Sutta, which took place not too long after that, the Kassapa brothers, the thousand fire ascetics, and this is like 4, 5, 6. So four noble truths in the Dhammacakka Sutta, then the five khandhas being taught about in the Anattalakkhana Sutta, and then the six sense bases being the framework for the fire sermon, the Adita Pariyaya Sutta. And taking these four noble truths, when the Buddha talks about the four noble truths, you have the dukkha. Dukkha is present. Dukkha is something which is there, which exists. You have the samudaya, which is the cause of dukkha, that being craving, tanha. Then you have the nirodha, which is the cessation of dukkha, and the magga, which is the path leading to the cessation of dukkha. And in the Anattalakkhana Sutta, you've got the five khandhas. So that's form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. And sometimes these questions will come up, like, what are these five khandhas? And this is just one way, one framework the Buddha comes up with about how to describe this body and mind, that we have bodies and we walk around, we can move around, we can do things, and then we have various feelings and perceptions and thoughts, and we experience. Consciousness would be that, the fact that we can experience things. So form would be the four elements, earth, water, fire, air. These make up the body. The earth element being that which is solid, the solid parts of the body, the bones, for example, the framework of the body, that which keeps us upright. And water, there's blood in the body, there's water in the body, there's various fluids that move throughout the body in order to keep it working properly. there's the fire, which is like the temperature in the body, the fire element. Also, it regulates digestion. Air element is like the breathing. And then also it's the kinetic energy in the body. So the motion of the circulatory system and so on. These four elements making up the body. This is like the physical body. And then the feelings. Feeling is experienced in the mind, but it'll have the body as a basis, unless it's feelings based in the mind, such as moods and emotions that cause various feelings for us. And perception. You know, perception is the way we recognition of things, the way we're conditioned to recognize things, colors, for example, and recognizing just basic modalities of experience. And then the sankharas, the mental formations, thoughts, moods, emotions, and so on, and consciousness, which is, I like to think of consciousness as, this is sometimes an obscure one, I like to think of it as what we pay attention to or how we use our attention. So there's attention and then there's intention. Intention is kamma. There's intention, intentional action. Good action, which has good results. Bad action, which has bad results. And good, mixed good and bad action, which has mixed good and bad results. And then there's the imperturbable kamma, which refers to the Noble Eightfold Path. So that's a very special type of kamma, and that's what's called the kamma leading to the ending of kamma. Very, very special type of kamma, very special type of action. So when we follow the Noble Eightfold Path in its various facets, and we could summarize that by saying sila samadhi panya, virtue, meditation or mental cultivation, discernment, wisdom. That's a summary of the Noble Eightfold Path. Sila samadhi panya, easy to remember. And getting to the Dhamma isn't a formulaic thing. It's not just about getting the test questions right. It's not like becoming an upajaya where you just have to get the test questions right. So if we're talking about the heart, then it's not formulaic. It's more about the ripening of the path, the maturation of the path, or we could say the eventual integration of the path into our lives. We could also say that Dhamma practice is the adaptation and the modification of our behavior by body, speech, and mind to be more wholesome and less unwholesome. And so how do we do that? Sometimes we can take a very harsh view of the path and a harsh view of ourselves. If we take a harsh view of ourselves, we might think, I have so much greed, I have so much anger, and I can't work with it. And it just doesn't seem to be going away no matter how much I meditate. And so to look at that, and this comes back to the sutta on not self. It's like you look at the phraseology in the English translation, like mental formations are not self. If mental formations were self, then I could say, may my mental formations be thus, may they not be thus. But because mental formations are not self, one cannot say, may my mental formations be thus, may my mental formations not be thus. So it's looking at these things and thinking, okay, this is just how things are based on causes and conditions. So developing that reflective mindset. And as practitioners, we become very reflective. We reflect on our behavior of body, speech, and mind. And before we act, we reflect. And so looking at these things and really what needs to be adapted in the moment of, I have so much greed, I have so much anger, and so on. Then what needs to be adapted is looking at that attitude, that underlying attitude of, I have so much greed, I have so much anger. Rather than following those thoughts, which the result of following those thoughts is, I have so much greed, I have so much anger, I have to get rid of all that greed, I have to get rid of all that anger. And I know growing up as a monk, I've heard these teachings so many times. And over time, reflecting on them, and all right, that's the obscuration. It's not what I think is the greed, what I think is the anger, that those judgmental, critical attitudes I have toward myself, that is what needs to be looked at. That is what needs to be questioned. That is what needs to be settled. That is what needs to be calmed. And then through this very natural process of sila samadhi panya, the mind can start to drop these things, and it'll happen very naturally. The image of water being filtered is a good one, or the image of water settling. If anybody's ever done adobe building, if anybody here has ever done building of using earth to build a structure, then you have to test the earth first, and you do what's called a settlement test. Whatever earth you're going to use, you want to know the percentages of coarse sand, fine sand, soil, and clay. You need to know those percentages before you know it's going to be a good adobe building material. And so you do the shake test. You'll take some of this earth, put it in a jar of water, shake it up, and just set it down. And that those different materials will stratify in the jar, and then you'll know, okay, there's this percentage of coarse sand, there's this percentage of fine sand, there's this percentage of soil, there's this percentage of clay. So the coarse sand settles pretty quickly. You could liken that to sitting down and meditating for an hour a day, or putting effort into just reflecting on Dhamma and reflecting on our own behavior for a little bit a day. It doesn't take that long for that coarse sand to settle to the bottom. But the water is still murky. So then there's the finer sand. The finer sand takes longer. But then if the jar is just sitting there, if we just allow it to follow its own nature and it's just sitting there, then the fine sand will settle on top of the coarse sand, and you'll have a layer of coarse sand, you'll have a layer of fine sand. You'll be able to tell there's this percentage of coarse sand, there's this percentage of fine sand. But then if we go and grab the jar and shake it up again, then we have to start over. We have to set it down again, and it's got to resettle again. We leave the jar there long enough, those first two layers, coarse sand, fine sand, and then the soil will settle. It'll stratify on another layer on top of that. And then it takes quite some time then for the clay to settle. So it might take a day or two. And if we don't move that jar, then sure enough, the fine clay will settle on the top. And then on the top of that, we'll have clear water. So the water, it can get filtered by a natural settling process. I think that's very much like the mind, except it takes way longer than that. It takes way longer. But still, it is the same concept, the same idea, that if we don't stir the mind up too much by using consciousness to pay attention to various things that might stir the mind up, then there will be this natural settling process. And so we talk about something like letting go, and that doesn't happen just by wanting to let go or just by act of will. Again, coming back to the not self teaching, is if I could just let go, I would say, well, mind, just let go, and then it would let go. But because I can't just say mind, just let go, then it's not self. So it has to be this natural settling process. It's not through me imposing my will on the mind. That is the mind. The imposition of the will is the non-settlement. It is the shaking it up. So stepping back and looking at that, reflecting on that, the natural result of following the teaching of Sila Samadhipanya is that the mind will start to feel okay. It'll start to feel content, start to feel happy. The natural result of acknowledging that, see, the way we train as monastics, acknowledging, being able to honestly acknowledge when there's been some sort of fault or a mistake has been made, being able to acknowledge that and then reflect on that and reform our behavior, then that result of that is that the mind will start to feel a bit more strong, confident, content, happy. The mind will feel glad and happy. And that's the natural result of the practice. When there are those inevitable failures or mistakes that get made, then there might be some sort of sense of discontent or embarrassment even. But then if we can acknowledge that, adapt ourselves, and keep moving forward without giving up. And I know for me, myself, so many times there's been this impulse to just want to give up. It's like, okay, well, I've messed up so many times, I might as well just give up. Really, the it only ends when we really give up. If we keep moving forward, then we can't not make progress. If we keep putting effort into Sila Samadhipanya, we can't not make progress, because progress or the settling of the mind is just going to be a natural result. If the fruit stays on the tree long enough, it's going to get ripe. It doesn't just stay in its same state. It will evolve in a certain way. So if we keep practicing, it will evolve. It will get better, to the extent that we're able to cultivate things like patience. When Lungpa Cha was asked what were the things that he thought caused him to succeed in his practice, what were the qualities that he found the most helpful, and he answered that it was patient endurance and reflecting on uncertainty. That is very interesting to me, that it was patience. Patience and reflecting on anicchang, on impermanence, uncertainty. Because he didn't say samadhi. You know, samadhi is the most important. Or he didn't say anything else. He said those two qualities of kanti, patient endurance, and the reflecting on uncertainty that were most important for him. There can be very deep meditation experiences that we can have. And yet, that's like, heard the simile of, it's like stepping on grass or putting a rock on grass. When you pick the rock up, the grass just stands up again. So it's like putting a weight on the defilements. They'll be repressed temporarily, and then we pick it up, and then the grass just stands back up. They haven't really gone anywhere. But that's more the function of discernment. And discernment is going to come from reflecting on uncertainty and impermanence. In the teachings, they say that the samadhi is necessary for being able to see it in a refined way. And another thing Lungpa Cha was asked was, how much samadhi do I need? This is something the Westerners would like to ask him. How much samadhi do I need? Which jhana level do I need? And he would say, enough to be able to let go. So really, you know, we can get it. If we study these things in an academic way, we can get into the nitty-gritty of, well, what's the difference between this jhana and that jhana and so on. And those are all good things to study. But to remember that these are also books and words, and we do need to develop that reflective capacity to come back to the experience in the heart. And so sometimes we'll meet somebody like for the generation that came before myself and my generation of Lungpa Pasano and so on, being able to meet, having the blessing to be able to meet Lungpa Cha in person, for myself, meeting people like Lungpa Liam and having these experiences of just being able to see somebody who is with the heart of that certain Dhamma quality, which gives rise to confidence and faith and inspiration. I think of a story when Lungpa Cha took Lungpa Samedo, who was probably Tan Samedo at that time, maybe not even yet an Ajahn, and took him to see Lungpu Khao, who was actually sick and dying at the time. And Lungpa Samedo relating that it was just how incredibly radiant he was. So this monk who is incredibly ill and dying, and just beaming, just glowing. And he didn't really say much. So they paid their respects. And then as they were leaving, then Lungpu Khao saying, hey, hey, hey. And then kind of getting Ajahn Sumedho's attention. And then pointing to his heart, saying, it's all here. It's all here. It's not anywhere else. And that how that those things like that are the transformative experiences that we end up having more often than reading the right teaching in a book or in a sutta in the text. Those, not to belittle the importance of those are very important. And for example, I'm very grateful that sutta studies are happening from time to time in the monastery currently. Those are extremely important. And yet those really transformative experiences, those end up perhaps happening when we least expect it. Sometimes we might even just be going for a walk on the trail and we stop and think, I feel happy right now. Wow. Amazing. You know, how unusual is that? That comes from causes and conditions. And when the Buddha talks about, so this is just getting our minds around a basic understanding of Dhamma, when the Buddha talks about the wholesome and the unwholesome, the definition of the wholesome is happiness is the result. Definition of the unwholesome is suffering is the result. So we class something as wholesome because it leads to well-being and purity of heart. And we class something as unwholesome because it leads to suffering and discontent. And so we can work backwards in our practice and say, well, if there is suffering, there is suffering. So what is the cause of suffering? There's unwholesome qualities that must have played into that somehow. Or if we feel happiness, there must have been some wholesome qualities that played into that somehow. Of course, for all of us, it's going to be mixed. It's going to be a mixture of happiness and suffering. And again, to be careful of that judgmental critical mind, if we think, well, we're suffering, so there must have been an unwholesome qualities, so I'm hopeless, I'm a bad person, and so on, that's we have to be careful of that, because that in itself is the unwholesome quality that we have to be careful of. And it's a habit. So it's about changing the habits, curbing the habits. We can't just do a 180. We can curb the habits using the path, using the Sila Samadhi Panya. We can curb the habits from the unwholesome to the wholesome. And some people from a young age will already have a lot of wholesome qualities. It really depends on each individual's spiritual qualities, each individual's paramis, and everybody's going to be different. Everybody's at a different place, but we all have to do the work at some point. So there's the wholesome and there's the unwholesome. And sometimes people also ask about, you know, relating to current events in the world, which are horrific and tragic and everything. And if we feel happy, we might ask ourselves, oh, how could I feel happy at a time like this? You know, it's like almost like there's a virtue to suffering. We might be conditioned to see that it's really good to be unhappy about about horrific things happening in the world. And of course, a visceral reaction will happen if we to a normal person who sees bad things happening. However, if we have those causes and conditions already in place, those wholesome qualities are already in place, the mind is going to be happy because that's just the result of wholesome qualities. So whatever is happening around us, the mind is going to be happy. The mind is going to be content, irrespective of what's happening around us. And there's another framework the Buddha uses, the fire sermon, the six sense bases. And this deals much more with consciousness. So the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind, and the eye consciousness. And so we can experience through the eye, through the ear, through the nose, through the tongue, through the body, and we can experience through the mind. And sometimes we need to spice our practice up a bit, make it a bit more interesting. We can think as a thought experiment. We can try to think, is there a possibility to have just a mental object that's not based on any of those five senses? So normally our thoughts will take the form of words. Some of us think in terms of words. So the like nattering that goes on in the mind, like, oh, this is this way, that's that way, and so on. Or I need to do this, I need to do that. There's a voice that goes on in the mind. For some people, it's imagery. So the voice on the mind would be based in the ear, but it's happening in the mind. Our thoughts take the form of the ear. Our thoughts can take the form of the eye, which is the images, mental images. Those can be produced as thoughts. We can think or recollect smells. We can think and recollect tastes. We can think and recollect about tactile sensations. But can we think about something that isn't any of those things? It's always going to be a word in the mind. It's always going to be an image, or even if it's light, that's an image. So that's sometimes we can use these six sense, this contemplation of the six sense bases in order to do these types of thought experiments. If we like to investigate, then we can do something like that in order to help the mind to settle a little bit more. And then there's techniques for grounding our practice. If we want to have a daily practice, we're trying to find one or two chants that we do every day, or maybe bowing to a shrine, the first thing we do every day, and that conditions perhaps how our day will go. Doing a, like, say, taking one chant and never missing that chant, doing that every day, no matter what, and something that is sustainable for us, that it's good to have a constant in our practice, something we do every single day, no matter what, without fail. Then if we have that, whether it's just one or two chants, or we meditate for 5 minutes even, if there's that constant, or if we like to use a mala, then doing 108 of a certain short mantra once a day, something we know we can do every day, then that's a technique for grounding our practice and getting building up over time. Monastery, we've already have the framework for this with the chanting and the pujas and so on. But for everybody who's not living in the monastery, then trying to find some way, some daily practice in order to create an anchor for ourselves. So these are just some ideas, some thoughts which have been coming up for me as of late, and very happy to see everybody here in Anumodana for your practice. And everybody here is practicing because you're here, so you're doing your best, and that's all we can do. And just to remind ourselves that there will be times we make mistakes or do things we might regret. There will be times when the unwholesome qualities end up causing suffering in the mind, but that's okay. That's just a natural part of the path, natural part of the practice. And the important thing is just to develop a reflective attitude and just to say, that's okay, how do I keep moving forward? How do I make use of these teachings, the Four Noble Truths, in order to look at my own experience and see where am I still getting stuck? Where am I actually succeeding and doing things right? And where is there a sense of peace? Where does the frustration and stress arise? When does it arise? And so on. So just want to, out of goodwill, just share a few of these thoughts on this Saturday evening, and we'll leave it there for this evening.